Monster Man, special episode, Mixed Monster Groups. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Tim. If you'd like to be like Tim and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get access to the rewards for all other tiers, including all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities. So Tim, thank you very much for your support, and I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Also, before we get started, it's time to thank a new Patreon backer. Yes, this is someone who has, as I said before, gone to patreon.com/monsterman, and they've pledged as little as $1 a month to help support the show. So thanks to Paul Frankel. Your support means a lot to me. Finally, the poll results for the next season of Monster Man are in, and a pretty convincing winner, it's Dark Sun. I know only a little bit about this setting, but we'll figure it out, and on Friday, we'll do an intro episode. Regular Dark Sun episodes will begin next week. But for now, let's get on with Tim's special episode. So, I was talking to Tim about this topic earlier, and he suggested that a lot of monster groups are sort of assumed to be monotype. You're going to fight a bunch of orcs, or a bunch of kobolds, or something like that. But in fact, cults and gangs and other kind of, armed organizations like that have historically often been quite diverse, offering a sense of belonging to individuals who've been outlawed or outcast from other groups. I find this idea interesting, and I'm sort of two minds about it. Let's take a look at some of the possible examples of this, like, mixing up the monsters being done successfully and unsuccessfully. In this episode, I'm going to be focusing more on the idea of mixing up monsters that are, like, of different types or of different that you would normally expect to see in different circumstances. So like the idea that this bunch of skeletons are led by a white is no big deal. But there are some monsters that you wouldn't expect to go together. And it's those ones that I'm mainly going to be focusing on. Now look, I know I always beat up on this specific example, but just really stuck with me. In the 5th edition scenario, Baldur's Gate Descent into Avernus, there's a bit where the Flaming Fist, the mercenary company that serves essentially as Baldur's Gate's police force, sends you to do a job, and then, if you don't do it, they send a squad of mercenaries to make you do it, and never you mind that if they're tough enough to force you to do the job, then they're tough enough to do the job themselves, and you wouldn't have to pay two lots of people. But leaving all that aside, I want to talk about this group in two aspects. First, let's talk about its composition. So, the soldiers all have the, if I remember correctly, the veteran stat block, which is just like a pretty tough soldier opponent, reasonably powerful considering that we're dealing with low-level characters at this stage in the campaign. And, like, maybe some of them are half-orcs and maybe some of them are dwarves, but for our purposes, they're all identical. There's no point in making them a point of to hit or a point of damage here and there if they're only going to turn up once and they're not really intended to be memorable. Indeed, I'd be surprised if any run of this campaign ever involved a fight with these characters, because why would you not want to go start the adventure, which is what you're being asked to do? And I think that making that group more diverse matters and is easier if you, like both Tim and I, are a miniatures person. I use a lot of models in my D&D game, and that kind of like creature diversity is very easy to convey in that way. So at present, my players are raiding the base of a local kind of like thieves guild / organized crime syndicate, which has this sort of funhouse dungeon, which is essentially a training academy for thieves. But they believe, well, correctly, they believe that these people have been sort of taken over by a vampire, and they've gone in to take out the vampire and rescue someone that they need, who's being held captive. Wanting some miniatures for the big final fight, I just went through the cases and grabbed whatever models caught my eye. So some of the thieves are halflings, some of them are goblins, whatever, right? I have a big collection of hundreds of fantasy miniatures, and just kind of grabbing whatever ones felt right to me meant I had some half-elves in there, you know? So this diversity among the characters was communicated visually. I don't have to stop during the fight and explain that this antagonist is a halfling and that antagonist is a lizard person, because the players can see that on the table in front of them. And what I'm trying to do in terms of my description is keep the fight flowing, not characterize a bunch of extras, especially since I have not altered the stat blocks at all, right? So some of them are bandits and some of them are scouts and some of them are swashbucklers and whatever, you know, using the like NPC templates in the back of the various books. But I'm not correcting, you know, for the slight differences in what it would mean for one of them to be a goblin and one of them to be a gnome, because that's not really how this fight's going to work. So what that means is that the only thing that's different about these characters is the thing that I'm able to communicate so easily, which is their appearance. I'm trying to keep this fight flowing, not characterize a bunch of extras that the PCs are never going to meet again. Now, secondly, to go back to the Flaming Fist guys, I know technically I am still talking about them. The second point about this group of Flaming Fist guys is I said they all had the veteran stat block. That's actually not true. All of the humanoids in the group have the veteran stat block, and there's also a flame skull hanging around with them. Now, I sort of get the reasons. The flame skull boosts the squad's firepower considerably, especially against parties with a lot of magic. And it sort of suggests that the leader of the Flaming Fist, or the leaders of the Flaming Fist, are the kind of dirtbags that would summon or create or whatever it is such a creature. But on the other hand, it doesn't quite line up with the overall vibe that you're supposed to be getting from the Flaming Fist. All of the encounters with the Flaming Fist that are in like the city section at the back are kind of down to earth, right? They're just trying to keep the peace in Baldur's Gate, and they're doing it in a way that suggests that they care more about whether, like, the rich people are having trouble than about right and wrong. A lot of their leaders, I think all of their leaders, are evil-aligned. But I think they're evil-aligned in the sense that they're kind of bullies and goons, and they just want to, like, push people around and collect emoluments from their rich patrons. I don't know that they're out here summoning flying skulls that shoot fire, except insofar as I guess that's something everybody does in the very fantastical world of D&D 5th edition. So just kind of like, they're meant to be a bunch of pragmatic mercenaries who don't care if they're doing something unethical, and it's a little weird to imagine these hard-drinking soldiers of fortune clocking in at the beginning of a workday and just like passing this flame skull floating in the lobby, you know? Morning, Gus. It doesn't quite work with the mood that you're supposed to have about the Flaming Fist, only it doesn't matter because the whole encounter is pointless in the first place. So even though the Flaming Skull makes sense from a kind of like tactical perspective, makes the fight challenging enough that the PCs don't just start bullying the Flaming Fist, from a vibes perspective, I think it's a little strange. So a lot of this conversation takes place against the backdrop of traditional fantasy worlds that envision societies that are essentially kind of tribal. I mean, you can see this in Middle Earth. In Middle Earth, you do have places like Bree, where there are both humans and halflings living, but I would say that those are the exceptions. Most of the time, what happens when characters in a Tolkien novel encounter a society is that that society is pretty uniformly composed of one type of being. It's all dwarfs, or it's all elves, or it's whatever. Now, maybe not 100%. There are stories about like, oh, you know, in the glory days of this society, then dwarves came and they built this thing there and so on and so forth. But even then, I think they're still kind of treated as very clearly foreigners. Tolkien is hearkening back to a vision of medieval or ancient history in which polities conceived of themselves as the expressions of particular peoples. Now, how accurate that is and how much that is just the way that those societies talked about themselves, well, we can see similar cases in the modern world, but that's the effect that he was going for. By contrast, I think that the assumption of what society is like in a sort of typical D&D 5th edition game, right? Like Baldur's Gate owes more to somewhere like New York or Chicago than it does to thinking about ancient or medieval history. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's meant to represent a modern kind of place. And like other modern kinds of place, it's very ethnically diverse. Although kind of culturally homogeneous, which is weird, but never mind about that. So when you have a mix of different monsters in an encounter, if they're these like intelligent creatures, you know, if it's orcs and kobolds and troglodytes and whatever, you're saying something about the type of society that they come from, or alternatively, you're providing a contrast to the type of society that they come from, right? It might be a mongrelmen type situation where lots of different creatures have banded together because that's sort of the only place they can go. So there are times when just having kind of a jumble of creatures illuminates the fact that that is unusual. If we're in one of these fantasy settings where most polities are kind of uniformly one species, then the fact that we're running into a group which is a mixture of all different species is itself saying something. Or by contrast, if it's the other way around, so if we are encountering monsters who are sort of species-wise uniform in a world where diversity is the norm, then that's telling us something about that group as well. You can see something a little bit like this, obviously not with monsters, in Star Trek. If you look at the USS Cerritos, it's got Bajorans and Orions and Cations and a Vulcan and so on and so forth. But whenever they encounter a spaceship from another polity within that universe, almost all of them, I have seen season 4, but you know, like if they run into a Klingon ship, it's all Klingons on there. So the fact that every monster group they encounter, every, you know, Klingon ship or pack-led ship or whatever, is all members of one species, is telling us something about Starfleet and its values. Now, you do sometimes get mixtures of creatures that don't make sense and don't illuminate anything about the creatures themselves. You see this with, like, older, not very well thought out dungeons where people are just, like, rolling randomly. And you see it with modern scenarios where a creature has been put into an encounter just because the author needed a monster of, you know, challenge rating X and stuck in a coatl, even though it doesn't make any sense because it was like the most interesting tactically or something like that. These are just both cases of creators having priorities other than informing the players about the world or creating a particular mood. So what is the key to making monsters work together in groups? I think it's to do with the concept that we've talked about in the past, this idea of the monster palette, right? Like, what is the range of different monsters that we have to choose from that we've already kind of pre-selected for being thematically or something else connected? Typically, when I talk about monster palettes, I'm thinking more thematically than ecologically. Putting together individual squads can sometimes be an exercise in expressing that group of monsters or going against it. For instance, let's take the humble bullywug. So bullywugs are fun, but fighting a bunch of bullywugs over and over again is not very exciting. And we'd like to suggest, again, this is kind of like tip of the iceberg storytelling, so I want to suggest that bullywug society is rich and complex without actually bothering to model the richness and complexity of bullywug society, because who's got the time? So instead, what I'm going to do is just make it seem like there's a lot of weird stuff going on in bullywug land. I might add some critters to their lineup, like other things that live in the swamp. Maybe there's troglodytes. Maybe there's, I don't know, gripplies. Maybe I show some evidence of the bullywugs interacting with their landscape and their biome. So for instance, maybe a bunch of bullywugs are frantically holding on to a bunch of chains around the neck of an alligator, or they're riding around on giant dragonflies. I could even add something that is incongruous and use the bullywugs to like rub some swamp funk on that thing. So, like, let's say a vampire fleeing from some vampire hunters escaped into the swamp, and with its mind control powers, it easily took over the hamlet of the bullywugs. And it's kind of, like, dark in here with all the cypress trees and Spanish moss and so forth, and, you know, now it's living in some kind of, like, damp southern gothic kind of rotted mansion deep in the swamp, but it hates it there and it wants to go back to its old castle in Fantasy Transylvania, but it can't go out because if it does, you know, all these Poundland Simon Belmonts are going to come at it with their various holy waters and sunbeam spells. And this gives me something of my swamp villain, like all in rags and tatters of its former finery, covered in mud and moss, desperately trying to keep some of its dignity. Maybe it's like training some of the bullywugs to be like its footmen or whatever. And that's kind of ridiculous because bullywugs are kind of ridiculous. That's a fun encounter. I'd love to go take out some vampire that's living in an old southern gothic mansion in the swamp, and some of the bullywugs might hate it, right? You might have like rebel bullywug freedom fighters hitting and running from the marshes, so you might get to team up with the bullywugs instead of massacring them for a change. Great. And all of that just occurred to me as I speculated about the interactions of these different kinds of monsters. I didn't have bullywug dominating swamp vampire up my sleeve while I was writing this episode. It just sort of emerged from the interaction of those types. So sometimes having a bunch of monsters that all kind of make sense together, and then throwing in one that doesn't make sense, can lead to a fun opportunity for creativity as you ask yourself, why does this in fact make sense? And there are some monsters where this works more easily than it does for others. So a good example would be like the Yikaria, the Yak Men of the Al-Qadim setting. Their whole deal is that they collect magical things. So if they had a reflector, or some bound djinn, or an iron cobra, or whatever, it would sort of make sense because having a big box of tricks is something that the Yikaria do as part of who they are. But at the same time, it would be really fun to think about why these orcs have a Pegasus or whatever, you know? That's not an animal you'd normally think to associate with orcs. Could be fun just to pick one random critter and insert it into your monster palette in a way that doesn't necessarily make sense, but see what kind of opportunity to be creative you can derive from that juxtaposition. Now, sometimes you don't want to go to that level of trouble. Sometimes you just have a bunch of bandits or cultists or mercenaries or whatever, and you just want to remind everybody that this is a weird world where there are lots of, like, animal people and what have you. You know, you want to remind them that, like, oh yeah, some of these guys are Arakocra. If that happens, what you want to do is just, probably you have got two members of this group that are characterized already. Like, there'll be a nice one and a mean one, or a smart one and a dumb one, or one that's sympathetic toward the player characters, but then, like, a devious underling who might betray them, you know. Those are sort of levels of characterization that you might have in any kind of antagonist group. Just take those two and remind yourself that one of them is an Athasian half-giant and one of them's a tabaxi or whatever. And then, because those are the ones that they talk to, that will put in the players' minds the image of this group as all being kind of weird and unique, without you having to go through and for every single mace-swinging AC-13 doofus in the enemy group having to decide what sort of mask this actor is wearing. Because insofar as these kinds of antagonist groups have important roles in, like, non-combat or non-strategic contexts, they are as groups. Not every individual is likely to really matter in that sense. So this is that kind of thing where you sketch a couple of details and then leave the players to establish a pattern from these details and fill in the rest themselves. So one other thing that Tim mentioned in our conversation is the idea of using a variety of monsters for tactical advantage. Tactical advantage conceived of from, like, an in-game level. So he gives the example of guards using cockatrices as defenses, presumably with some kind of system to protect themselves. So I want to slightly modify this idea and talk about how useful it is to vary monster types just for tactical variety. So for tactical benefit, it can be useful to keep, like, a pretty mixed bag of monsters. In fact, my example of, you know, oh, this one's an orc, but that one's a gnoll, like, they're all just, like, buff dudes that hit things. But once you get outside the realm of buff dudes that hit things, you can really change up what types of monsters you deploy. You can see some of this in existing monster palettes already. So, for instance, one reason that you get, like, wolves and spider swarms whenever you get vampires is that they fit in with the aesthetic. You know, listen to them. Children of the night. But another reason is that a wolf is a great remedy to, like, a cleric turning all of your skeletons and zombies. It's a fast-moving throat ripper on a team of monsters that is mainly slow-moving damage sponges. But here's the thing. It might seem that that's something that is, like, tactically advantageous to the enemy, which is not a bad thing, you know? Especially if you notice that player characters are tending to do the same thing over and over. I'm not saying that I started to develop strategies in response to the fact that the druid in the party that I run for has a tendency to, like, flood the zone with summons. I mean, I am doing that, but I'm not doing it as a way to, like, get back at the player or get one up on them. I'm doing it as a way to not make the fights be too similar to each other, because I don't think the players want that either. So this is not something that's just there to be, like, to the DM's advantage or whatever. Players with a variety of strategies and abilities appreciate the same in their opponents because it means that fights, like, we've talked in the past about choosing fights that have different stakes, fights that have different landscapes, and those are all things that mean fights are not the same every time. Well, I mean, that goes the same, indeed more so, for antagonists. So by changing up the composition of monster groups, and specifically choosing monsters that have unusual or unique abilities, not even necessarily ones that complement the monster team well, but just ones that don't require the same strategies to deal with, you can make those groups feel a little more novel and interesting to fight against, quite apart from whether they're more or less dangerous. They're newer, and that has a value in and of itself. Now, of course, I'm talking within the context of games that have like a relatively high level of that type of tactical detail. This isn't going to come up very much if you're playing like Tunnels and Trolls, and every monster is really just like, it's probably not this way in modern editions, but in the version that I played when I was younger, for the most part, monsters are just like a scale. They just go from like less dangerous to more dangerous. They're not very different from each other mechanically. There, the difference is going to be in their gimmicks and in any like non-combat way that you might be interacting with them, whether that's persuading them to leave you alone or figuring out how to break the curse that puts them there. So even then, in a relatively simple system, well, quite a simple system, there are ways to vary up the player engaging aspect of monsters that are more than just cosmetic. So those are my thoughts on effectively varying the composition of monster encounters. Tim, thank you very much, as always, for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, remember that if you want to be like Tim and get your own special episode, all you got to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. Patreon subscribers should be getting a bonus episode, and for the $2 and higher subscribers, a patron deities later on in the week. And then on Friday, we're going to be starting with an all new season of Monster Man as we take a look at the dusty, desolate world of Athas right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.